for the week of August 16th, 2020. This is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 506, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
Oh gosh, I've forgotten where the convention was supposed to be. Where was it going to be?
Milwaukee.
And not in Milwaukee. I'm Michael Gelt Sperling. The news came out. We are not Biden's vice presidential pick. I thought we would have been a great team for his team.
He could have had two for the price of one. I mean, we have no idea what we're doing, but still,
That's no disqualification. Disqualification for government.
Yeah, yes. Especially these days.
So the news this week is that Kamala Harris is the vice presidential pick for the Democratic Party. And in entertainment news, Dwayne Johnson is the highest paid actor in Hollywood, indeed in the world. I think those two stories are related.
And I hope you mean that they're related by blood of some kind. I don't know. How would they be related?
Well, I think there's a reason Kamala Harris is the vice presidential pick. And Dwayne Johnson is the most popular, the highest paid actor in Hollywood. He's hugely popular around the world. People of color are far more visible online, in TV, and film, and pop culture, and music. They're playing bigger and bigger roles in entertainment and in the world. And so that's why you're seeing we've had a person of color be president. Now a person of color, a woman, is going to be vice president. So I think that's
possibly, possibly she's running.
That's right. She's running.
Yes.
And so I think that's why we're seeing that she's already broken barriers, being the first woman of color and the first Asian American to be nominated for the vice presidential slot for a major American party. So that's very exciting. And I do think they're related. I think the more comfortable people are, they have Bill Cosby as America's dad. You have Will Smith as a huge actor, Dwayne Johnson. You have Oprah on television. That gets people recognizing, seeing our country the way it really is, rather than just the Leave It to Beaver world. And it makes a difference.
Well, you know what? I think two things. First off, that's right, kids. Tune in to Showbiz Sandbox, the only place where Bill Cosby is actually used in a positive light.
Well, he did play a positive role on his sitcom.
Right. Yeah. And number two, I think that Dwayne Johnson is the highest paid actor right now because he can do that funky thing with his eyebrow where
That is pretty good. I do have a correction to make. I think I'm accurate now. People who are paying $30 for Mulan on Disney Plus when that becomes available, they're not renting it for 48 hours. I beg your pardon. I just knocked my tray. But in fact, they will have access to it on Disney Plus for as long as they maintain their subscription. Okay, yeah. So that's a good thing. You're paying $30. It means you don't just have to watch in 48 hours. You can watch it, you know, 6 months, a year. Your kid wants to watch it again and again. But my question is, does that mean no one else on Disney Plus will ever have access to Mulan, or no one anywhere unless they pay $30? What's going on there?
I don't know. Okay, so I'll be straight. I have no idea. Mm-hmm. I do know that that kind of defeats the purpose of premium video on demand. The whole point is that you have the 48 hours to watch the movie at that price of $30, or in the case of Trolls, $20. If you have it until you no longer have a Disney Plus subscription, then what I would say is, great, invite the neighbors over tomorrow, and then the day after that, invite your friends from school over. I mean, what's the point? Then you can have 500 people watch it for $30.
They've bought it for access for a long period of time, but it does, again, muddy the waters. I can't imagine they won't ever make it available to other people on Disney Plus. Maybe it will come and go as some items do. They rotate in and out, but that one will always stay there if you pay for it. And maybe, again, people will be able to rent it in regular video on demand for 48 hours like they normally would, you know, 90 days later or something like that, just like they would if it had gone to theaters. But it just is yet another more confusing layer. I pay for Disney Plus. I expect to see Mulan. You know, you're telling me the new season of The Mandalorian ain't available unless I pay extra. I'm not happy about that. But I am happy we're going to have a new episode. I don't know how many people finished last week's episode. It was a big one, but there was a lot of news. We're going to have a good one this week, aren't we, Sperling?
That's true. And by the way, I would suggest definitely, I mean, even if it takes like two or three, I don't know, listens, like, you know, if you listen to it in chunks, that interview with Chris Fenton, I found to be really interesting. So I would say go back, listen to Chris Fenton on last week's episode, and then come back, listen to this week's episode, because this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we are still recovering from last week's big supersized episode. And, you know, you probably are too. But so we're going to keep this one brief, okay? Or at least brief by our standards, which means what? Only 2.5 hours, right?
Keep going.
Yeah, okay. Online gaming is where people take part in massive battles, but no one ever gets hurt. Well, in real life, the company behind Fortnite is taking on Apple, and one of them is definitely going to get hurt where it hurts most, or yeah, I guess get hurt where it counts most, really. And that is the bottom line. One might even say, this is an epic battle. Ooh, we'll explain.
Well done.
Yeah, on Inside Baseball, we'll look again at the two big stories of last week, because we don't think he actually made it to the end of the show. If you saw the episode or watched it or listened to it, it was 2 hours long and ran in the other direction. Well, Michael and I will recap our thoughts on both the WGA triumph over packaging and talent agents and AMC's, or at least AMC Theaters deal with Universal that shreds the theatrical window. As a bonus, Michael will use my own words against me. Wait, what? I should really look at these notes before I read them. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll discuss some of the week's top headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on last week's video on demand charts and get this, box office. Actual box office. Yes, ComScore is back, baby.
Well, no, this info is not coming from ComScore as such. I got it from Deadline Hollywood, but you did forward me that ComScore was making some information available. So that's cool. So there is, you know, spotty information on certain movies. Okay. So, but we're going to start with the video on demand chart. This is the North American chart for the most popular standard video on demand, meaning you're just paying $3 to $5 to rent it for 48 hours. This is what was most popular for the week of August 3rd through August 9th. And the most popular film in video on demand in North America 2 weeks ago, roughly, was The Tax Collector, an action film starring Shia LaBeouf, written and directed by David Ayer, who was behind Training Day and other flicks.
And apparently it made $1 million on video on demand.
Is that what they told you?
Yes.
Okay. That's not very good, is it? They only made $1 million?
That is apparently what was reported. And it's like up to 1.9 with...
Well, that's different. That's almost double.
No. 1.9 with, I guess it's theatrically being released in certain places.
So it's about 200,000 people rented it last week. Because it'd be about $3 to $5. So it'd have to be at least 250,000 people rented it.
Yes, correct.
Mm-hmm. Okay. At number two is The Secret, Dare to Dream. That's the Katie Holmes romantic film based on the self-help book. Not self-help book. I'm not sure what to call that, but The Secret. At number three is Kevin Bacon's horror flick, You Should Have Left. Always good advice when you're dealing with a haunted house. At number four is a new film, Made in Italy, starring Liam Neeson and his son. At number five is Trolls World Tour. We've been talking about that a lot. And number six is another horror flick. It's The Rental, the directorial debut of Dave Franco. At seven is the war film The Outpost. At eight is The High Note, starring Dakota Johnson. I feel like there were people in two big franchises, Twilight and 50 Shades of Grey. And you thought, oh my gosh, these movies are kind of really bad. They're popular, but who's going to escape? And the two stars of Twilight have really made unexpectedly interesting careers out of doing really arty, interesting films, whereas the people from 50 Shades of Grey, not so much. At number nine is Sonic the Hedgehog, and at number 10 is The Invisible Man. But we do have some actual box office, where it's always good to hear video on demand. There's money being made, though apparently not a lot, if only $1 million is the most at the top film of the week, especially a new film made. That really...
Yeah, look at SpongeBob SquarePants made $900. Oh, wait, no, I'm sorry. $900,000. That was the... ComScore sent out their email and it said it made $900. And I thought, that cannot be right. And sure enough, like an hour later, they said, we meant $900,000, by the way.
Oh, that's funny. Well, yeah, it's important, but that's still not that very much. But that's theater struggling to get back. I assumed video on demand would actually be a little bit more on fire, maybe doing better than usual. But certainly the numbers for The Tax Collector, if it only made $1 million, and that's the single most popular film, that's telling me that's barely a chart we're talking about. Really? You know, you're talking $8-9 million total for all the top 10 films. Is that worth covering?
I don't know. You got like five states. Theaters.
Well, we talked about Trolls World Tour making $100 million in premium video on demand. If regular video on demand is at that low a level right now, when I assume they would have a more captive audience than ever, that's you know, the pennies add up. But still, I'm a little surprised that it's that low. But we do have some actual.
I am trying to actually find where I saw that.
Maybe. Oh, okay. Maybe it was 1 million buys. At least that would be better. At least it'd be $3 to $5 million. All right. Well, we do have some actual box office figures thanks to Deadline Hollywood, the other trades, and ComScore. The number one film around the world, we think, is Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone in 3D. It's been reissued in China. It made about $13 million, and it's just about to hit, probably has by the end of day today, $1 billion worldwide. So that's two Harry Potter films that have now crossed the $1 billion mark. Congrats to them. And number two is the Korean flick Deliver Us from Evil. That made another $11 million. That's at $26 million worldwide. Then there's the Gerard Butler disaster flick Greenland. That made, I think, $3 million this week, and it's at $4 million as it expands into some new territories. Right below that, with just a little bit less, but still about $3 million, is Will Smith. We just talked about him. He's in Bad Boys for Life with Martin Lawrence. That is at $426 million worldwide. By the way, he's making a remake of Planes, Trains, and Automobiles with Kevin Hart. Works for me. At number five is Inception, the Christopher Nolan film that's been reissued, of course, along with Interstellar to pump interest in his new film, Tenet. That made $1.6 million, basically in China. That's at $830 million worldwide. Right below that is Padre, no hay más que uno, dos. That made another $1 million, I think. It's at about $8 million worldwide. Right below that, as ComScore told us, is the SpongeBob movie, Sponge on the Run, which opened up in about 300 locations in Canada, I guess, basically. That made $900,000. And then right below that still is Unhinged, which is made about $500,000 in North America. That's the Mel Gibson flick, right? Or is that Russell Crowe?
Russell Crowe,
thank you. And that made about $500,000 in the U.S. I don't know what its worldwide total is yet, but that is those are the biggest numbers that we have. It looks like the tax collector made about $200,000 in movie theaters.
So, and that was his second weekend.
Second weekend. So, yeah, you know, I mean, there's mostly drive-ins and a couple hundred screens. In that case, the tax collector was playing at 138 theaters around North America. So,
His first weekend, it made around $310,000.
Right.
And there's differing reports. I have $1 million and $2 million for its first weekend, which was last weekend. So it's probably over $3 or $4 million now.
Okay. Thank you for that. And AMC Theaters says, of course, as you would expect, they'll be blocking out space between reserved seats starting Monday. So if you book two seats, they will then block off the seat next to you so that there will be nobody right next to your party. So every time a party books, you book three seats, two seats, one seat, the seats on either side of you, of course, will be empty. So that's makes sense. I'm not surprised at all by that, but they were just announcing that. Everybody's trying to figure out the safe way to get people back into theaters.
You would do it with a ticket. You'd sell them the ticket, and then they'd come in. That's the way.
It's a lot more complicated than that. Coronavirus has changed everything. In fact, coronavirus is making news on Broadway. The musical Diana, there was a musical just about to open up on Broadway. It had been in previews, I think about 2 weeks of previews, and had another 2 weeks to go before it opened. It was at the Long Acre. It had already played in Canada in early days, and they've been reworked it and kept building it up, and now it opened on Broadway. It was in previews. It was about to open up a musical about Diana, Princess of Wales, and then COVID. So that happened, and now they've decided they're going to film the musical at the Long Acre with no audience, and they are going to premiere it on Netflix. That will appear on Netflix, of course, long before they open on Broadway. They're probably planning to open up sometime next year. I don't know if they've picked a particular date, but no matter what it is, it may or may not get pushed because all these decisions are preliminary. But they believe their show is strong enough that people can watch it on Netflix. That's not going to make them say, I've seen it already. It's like Hamilton. They're going to see Hamilton on Netflix and go, man, I want to see that live. You know, no matter how good it is, it's only going to make you want to see the show more unless it's not good. So they have confidence in Diana. They believe it will drive people to the theaters when theaters come back up. I'm assuming they'll eventually take it down so it won't be up forever. When they're back on Broadway, it won't be available on Netflix so that, you know, or maybe just for a night or two again. But they're just going to say, hey, we think this is the way to go. It's worth it. It's a great promotional thing. We're going to feed people's interest and excitement. And when we do open up live, people will be lined up because they will have seen it. They love it. They know all the songs and they're ready to go. It works for revivals. There's no reason why it shouldn't work for Diana, assuming the show is good.
Well, okay, a couple things. Yes, it works for revivals. There are cast albums, and I guess when you say it works for revivals, they can't go to Netflix and watch
the actual... I'm saying they already know the show. They already know the show. They've been expected. It's been made into a movie. It's a revival, whatever. There's lots of cases where people go to see a show they've already seen in one form or another.
I was going to make a joke about how, you know, the producers of Diana looked at the success of Hamilton, and they're just getting it wrong, right? Like, you're not supposed to put your stuff on a streaming service and then try and make your show a phenomenon on Broadway. You're supposed to be a phenomenon on Broadway and then put your musical on a streaming service.
There you go. That's why you're not a Broadway producer.
Yeah, apparently.
Well, you are a video game player, but not much, are you?
I can barely spell video game.
You demanded. I had this story in Big Deal or Big Whoop. You said, no, this is much bigger than that.
I said, let's put it in Inside Baseball. You said, no, this story, we have better stories to put in Inside Baseball. And I said, okay.
I made it our main feature.
So Apple, well, it's an Epic story. Oh,
yeah, golly. Apple and Epic, which is the maker of Fortnite, are beginning a major legal battle. So this is going to take a long time to play out, but here's what's happening. Apple just blocked the makers of Fortnite from the App Store. Why? Because the company knowingly said, hey, we're not going to give you our 30% cut every time we make a sale anymore. So Apple and Google Play said, you've broken the terms of service. You got to get off. In response, Epic is suing. It's another battle in the war between Apple and all the companies that make apps, between Apple's demand for a 30% cut of any sales and everyone else's desire to keep that 30% for themselves. Apple says Epic just needs to follow the rules, as it did for a decade, using Apple and its App Store to launch its world-beating franchise. They liked it when they were nobody and they could reach Apple's audience and make lots of money. Epic, on the other hand, says Apple's monopolistic practices must end. And they tossed in a parody of Apple's classic 1984 commercial to drive its point home. And just to show they're serious, Epic even launched the hashtag Free Fortnite. Oh, snap. So what's going on here, Sperling? Why is this important? Two big companies are suing each other.
So that's one way of putting it, right? How you described it. So here's the deal. So this month alone, or maybe it was July, Fortnite made a fortune on the Apple Store. And I'm just going to take the Apple Store first. This is an app store where if you want your app there, as you said, Michael, you pay 30% of any in-app purchases. Now, Fortnite sells these coins and you can buy skins and you can buy all sorts of in-game purchases, right? Mm-hmm. And so what, I mean, first of
right,
all,
well, one estimate says Fortnite has generated $1.2 billion since March of 2018 via iPhones and iPads alone. So via the App Store since 2 years ago, 2 years and a couple months, they have generated $1.2 billion in sales. If so, Apple would keep $360 million of it. So they're making a lot of money, but they're saying, how come Apple gets, you know, all that money? We'd like to keep more of that for ourselves, right?
Right. I mean, so then there are some people comparing this to, look, if you're the Gap and you're selling clothes and you want to, you know, have your store in a mall, well, you pay rent, right? Well, this is just the rent for being in the Apple Store.
Well, no, this would be as if the mall took a third of all your sales. So you're the Gap at the mall. And instead of just paying rent, they say, we're taking a third of all your sales. You'd say, well, I'd rather pay a much lower rent or no fee at all, because we're driving people to want to use your phone. And you're happy because customers buy the iPhone because we create a great app that plays on your iPhone and makes it more valuable to them. Thus, they stay in the Apple world.
Right. Well, and that is precisely the problem here. So, you know, so the question was, well, why now? Well, I'll tell you why now. So a couple weeks ago, there were all those technology bigwigs, those tech company bigwigs. You had Zuckerberg and Jeff Bezos and Tim Cook from Apple and Sundar Pichai of Google. You know, they were all there.
In front of Congress,
because they were all there remotely. But yeah, and really what Congress is doing is looking into antitrust issues and antitrust allegations. And for a very long time, since the beginning of the App Store, both Google and Apple, developers, software developers and app developers have said, look, This is a problem. You're taking 30% of all of our sales. Now, you might think none of this has anything to do with entertainment. Why are Michael and Sperling covering
this? Well, of course it does, because all music sales, there's big fights about that, movies. Of course, the video games are part of the entertainment industry.
Well,
what are you talking about?
Spotify, when they got into a big tiff because basically Spotify said, we're not going to allow people to subscribe to Spotify through the app. You're going to have to actually go online, and that's exactly what Epic did. They said, you know what? No more buying coins and stuff through the app. You have to go online and purchase it that way, which is kind of a workaround, so they don't have to give Apple or Google 30% of the fee. So, you know, this is Tim Sweeney, the head of Epic Games, is basically itching for a fight here. He knew what was going to happen when he changed this policy,
they were prepared. Yeah.
They had a 60-page lawsuit waiting, and they had this commercial that you said. So what is it? Why is this a big deal? And I know it's not a big deal or big whoop, but why is it a big deal? Well,
it's a lot of money at stake.
There's a lot of money at stake. Epic is saying, we're willing to lose billions of dollars to go to war with you, not only for our own benefit, but for the benefit of all software developers.
Well, they're not doing it for the love of others. They're doing it for themselves and only themselves. They're not doing it because of the kindness of their heart. Well, you just said they're doing it for all. No, they're doing it because they want to keep more of their own money.
I'm paraphrasing Tim Sweeney in the Wall Street Journal.
Well, don't paraphrase him when he's being a fool and lying. I'm doing it for everybody else. No, he's doing it for his big multi-billion dollar company. Here's why it's happening now. As you said, Congress has been looking at big tech and seeing antitrust issues, monopolistic practices. Apple also is launching a new iPhone in the fall. Well, they launch a new iPhone every fall. However, this is one of the bigger ones. You know, it's been a few years since there's been a big major innovation, and this is a big one that they're pushing forward. Apple is also making a big push into services, meaning they're making more and more money by selling people stuff on a regular basis, content or access to content. They have Apple News. They have Apple Music. They have their video game subscription. Right. They have their cloud service. And any minute now, they are going to be announcing Apple One, in which they bundle them all together, pay them a monthly fee, and you'll get Apple Music, you'll get Apple News, you'll get some extra room in your cloud service, and you'll get their Apple Gaming service, their direct competitor to Epic and all these other companies. And they're trying to push people towards, hey, you're paying 20 or 25 bucks a month for all these services, and look at all these great games you have. Maybe you'll be spending less time on Epic. So that's what Apple is doing. And Epic is saying, okay, we're going to be losing money short term, but long term, you know, we could be gaining a lot if we can claw back that $300 million from the last 2 years.
Well, and then you had Google forcing OnePlus, which is an electronics manufacturer out of China. They make phones. They use Google Android system as their operating system. And OnePlus had cut a deal with Epic to put a Fortnite launcher actually on the phone so that when you get your phone, one of the default
it's
programs...
there already, yeah.
Right. Google forced them not to do that. And you have basically two operating systems, Google's Android or Apple's iOS. And what Epic is saying is, look, you guys have monopoly and you're really acting in an antitrust way. If I go to a third party and I cut a deal with them, you can't come in and undo the deal because you happen to own the operating system that they are using.
But it's just my store. If I'm Macy's and you want to sell your new belt in my store, we may decide to carry it, but we're going to get cut of the sale. If you don't want to be in my store, don't put it in my store. Go somewhere else.
So if OnePlus wanted to get a part of that, because in this case, what you just
described...
Apple
Plus?
No. OnePlus is the electronics manufacturer.
Oh, right.
They're the Macy's in that regard. They're the ones saying, we will put you on our phone. Now, our phone happens to be made with Google Android. So in that case, it would be Macy's saying, we'll put you in our store. Now, our store happens to be made with bricks and mortar, but the bricks and mortar company doesn't get any cut of it.
No, if you're agreeing to use their operating system, you agree to certain rules. And so they're saying you cannot favor this one company over another doing the way you're doing it, or you got to use a different operating system. Knock yourself out. You don't want to use Android? Don't. You do. These are the rules. I'm not saying that that's fair, but that's what they're saying. But is Epic being hypocritical? Because they're talking about Google and to a much bigger degree, Apple, and how they have this, you know, control over sales. What about the biggest walled garden in all of gaming? Consoles.
Oh, consoles? Yeah, I knew you were going to go there.
So
yeah,
there you go. Consoles, right? You're on PlayStation 4. They're not selling stuff for other consoles. It only has to work for their one. They want exclusive a lot of the time, meaning it's not available anywhere else. That's what they demand if you want to get a big lot of profile and a lot of promotion from them. So there's a lot of stuff going on in the gaming world, but there's also a lot of other options.
In regard to consoles, what Epic did last year, and this took a long time, months and months of negotiations, for Fortnite, what they did was they went to all the console manufacturers and they said, listen, you know, we have this ecosystem and we want people who are playing on the PlayStation 4 or 5 or whatever they're up to now, and the Xbox, I think it's one, or this should tell you that I'm not a big gamer. Whatever the latest consoles are, we want these people to be able to download Fortnite on their individual consoles and then play with each other. So a Fortnite PlayStation person can play with an Xbox Fortnite player. And they actually were able to do that. Now, part of the reason that some of there's some of these walled gardens is because of the way consoles work. If you're developing a game for one console, it's not as easy necessarily to port it to another.
Well, you need the specs and all that. And when it's a new console, they're only giving it to, you know, exclusive people who are agreeing to make content exclusively for them. If you want the latest specs and the latest things so that you can make it work really well, then you've got to work with us.
Right. It's in a different programming language, et cetera. Yeah. I mean, so some of those walls are coming down. Epic did try to do this one thing for Fortnite where it would, at least if you were going to stay in your walled garden, you could at least throw stuff over the fence. Now that said, there are a couple of ways this could go. Okay, Apple could just back down and say, you know what, Epic,
But what's realistic? We know there's 17 options they could sue.
There's really only six.
Well, there's really only six list options. What do you think is going to happen?
What do I think? I think one of about four things will happen. I don't think Apple will settle before going to trial. So I think that's out.
So they're not going to say, what if we say 20% commission? And they obviously they'd have to offer it to everyone. Yeah.
Correct. So I don't think they're going to settle like that. Epic could win the lawsuit, but that's going to take forever. Epic could lose the lawsuit outright, but then Congress could come in and say, you know what? Epic brought our attention to you. Thank you, Epic, for showing us this is a big problem, this antitrust that you've got going on here. And actually, Congress and in the U.S. could do something about it, but, you know, it's Congress, so their keyword is doing nothing. Holding lots of hearings about stuff, but then doing nothing. Or nothing could change at all. But I think in the end, a deal will be cut. I don't necessarily know that it will be a deal that will benefit everybody. I think what Apple will say is, if you are of a certain level, then we will...
You get lower commission. Yeah, yeah. You're generating that much money, you get 20%, maybe down to 10% or 15%.
Correct.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, but if they
want, by the way, they do with Netflix, I believe. I could be wrong about that. They do it with certain people. I know that Apple has a deal with one or two people, but it is a very special deal.
Well, we have breaking news for the movie theaters industry, and it's not good news. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo has given the green light to gyms. Gyms can reopen starting August 24th in New York State. That follows up on recent nods to bowling alleys, museums, and malls. But he is still not ready to give a green light for movie theaters. He sees them as simply risky, too risky, not worth the level of risk that they would create. And so other people are saying, what are you talking about? We've had hundreds of screens open all over the country. We haven't had any reports of like a cluster of outbreaks due to people going to movie theaters. We've got all these new restrictions in place. If people can eat indoors or do other things, if they can go to a gym for 40 minutes, why shouldn't they be able to go to a movie theater for 2 hours? And of course, it's a big ripple effect, because if you don't open up one of the biggest markets in America, how quickly, they're not going to show Tenet, right? If they're not going to open in New York, they're probably not going to open California, and then the whole country is lost.
It is, you know, yes. You're right. It's breaking news. I suspect that in the 2 weeks before Tennant opens, there will be a lawsuit which forces Andrew Cuomo's hands, because there is no way you can say, oh, no, a church is fine. A church is fine. Those
lawsuits are already happening.
Yeah. And by the way, just scientifically here, what has been proven by UC Davis is that in a gym where people are huffing and puffing and most often not wearing masks, they're actually potentially breathing out more virus. Whereas people sitting in a movie theater or a legit theater where they are not exerting themselves with a mask on are actually not spewing out as much of their, aerosolizing as much of the virus.
Right. Let's just say one study indicated.
Great. Yeah, it was what UC Davis
right.
did. That.
Right. Yeah. Someone did it. Yeah. They also did this crappy, mask test, which is on all the news. One test done once on 8 different types of masks. Oh, here, look. Oh, it's like, why would you do one test? Why wouldn't you run it 20 times or 50 times? And why is it just one study that tells us nothing?
Davis.
No, I'm just saying, every time you do poor reporting like that, like, oh, study proves, it's like, let 10 studies be done, let 100, and let collate all the information. Then you're going to start talking about some scientific, knowledge that you can depend on. But a single study at a single place, a single time, isn't proof of anything.
Well, I know that NATO, the National Association of Theater Owners here in the United States, is actually asking people to sign on to like a reopening. They're trying to standardize how theaters reopen and how they're training their employees and making them wash their hands. Now, enforcement is everything, right? Like, how do you actually follow up and make sure people are
just like every restaurant and every place in the world, there's always standards and you have people.
And I can tell you this. That the exhibitors I've spoken to, they are going above and beyond trying to not be the vector. They don't want to, they don't ever want it coming out that because they were lax, some outbreak started.
Right. It may not even be being lax, though. If people sit in a room for 2.5 hours eating popcorn and drinking soda and watching a movie, it's possible it could spread to other people, even if you follow all the safety protocols. I certainly hope that's not the case. They're talking about, hey, stadium seating, that keeps people sort of pretty lot farther apart than they used to be, so that's a helpful thing. I certainly want the industry to get back when it can safely, but I don't know if it's safe. I don't know if I'm going to go see Tenet, sit in a theater for 2 hours in a full, third capacity theater filled to the brim as much as it can be. I don't know. I don't know if I'll be comfortable doing it.
And everybody said, oh, well, people will spread out their viewing. Well, they'll watch it at 10 a.m., right?
Yeah, no, they won't. People have lives.
I have spoken to a couple of exhibitors, a couple of big international exhibitors where they have theaters in more than one location or more than one country. And at least here in North America, the problem is staffing costs so much that to then limit the
capacity. Yeah, you're really, you've got your main. Yeah, yeah.
That's the problem. It's not that they don't want, they understand the limiting of capacity. They understand why it needs to happen. But then what they're saying is, we do need the 50% to show up. So maybe we'll only do 2 shows. And that way we don't have to open at 10 in the morning.
Right. Because there's no point. People are not, people have been working from home, but they're not suddenly free all day long like they were for a weird few weeks when everything paused. People are now, they've got kids in school, they've got to teach their kids, or they've got work to do. They don't have the freedom to just go to the movies whenever they want suddenly. It's a big mess. The governor's made a big announcement. He's letting almost everybody open up except movie theaters and, of course, live venues and Broadway. New movie theaters aren't alone here. There are these multiple areas of entertainment that all seem to be higher risk than a lot of other things. I guess going to see a movie outdoors is the best way to go.
Well, and the number of pop-ups that are occurring here in Southern California is pretty turn.
It's fun. It's great. But it's no replacement for the, obviously, the infrastructure of the industry. It's just fun. It's a fun little thing to do to entertain people. It's not going to be a long-term fix to getting grosses back to where they need to be.
No, that is true.
I did say the word big, by the way, a minute ago. I did say Andrew Cuomo made a big announcement.
But you didn't say that the deal was closed or something like that. You didn't put the word deal in there.
It was a layup. I thought it was a layup.
Okay. Well, it was more of like an alley-oop. Mm-hmm. In which I was supposed to pick up on and then say that it must be time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, Steiner Studio is a big player in film and TV production in New York City. You probably know them, Michael.
Yep.
Now it's getting even bigger. The company is building a 500,000 square foot production facility in the Sunset Park area of Brooklyn. And that should pair nicely with the 780,000 square foot facility it already has at the Brooklyn Navy Yard, the home of shows like The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel and the film version of Joker. You know, with that much space, they could have, oh, actually only one, unless they have a soundstage in between the two productions. In any case, filming may be paused or slowly coming back to life, but Steiner is proof that someday, soon hopefully, film and TV will be back in action. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big deal. People have to think long term. We will get to the other end of this pandemic. People will be making film and TV again. It may not be the same way as before. I hope this new studio has lots of swinging doors so people don't have to use handles. But it's going to happen. And so they're getting ready for the future, and it's good to see.
Pension and health plans. Big deal or big what? No, just kidding.
Since I don't have one, it's a big deal.
Yeah, well, they are always top concerns when negotiating new deals for union members. And SAG-AFTRA, the Screen Actors Guild, and the, I never should have gone down this road because
you
now
really
I'm
going to shouldn't have. You really shouldn't
Association
have.
Association of Federal TV and Radio Actors, I don't know. They are showing why these pension and health plans are a big deal. Facing a huge deficit for its health plan, the Actors Guild announced it would change eligibility starting next January. Ooh, maybe we'll be eligible, Michael. Members would need to gross about $25,000 in a year to qualify for health benefits, up a huge 40% from from previous levels of $18,000 a year. Guess what, Michael? We will not qualify for either, okay? That means thousands of SAG-AFTRA members and their dependents would lose health coverage, and this amidst a pandemic. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a very big deal. People are already raising petitions to say, no, don't do this. Not only should you not do this, doing this now right amidst the pandemic is unconscionable. And obviously, actors are often unemployed. You know, like 90% of actors at any time are out of work, just because the way work is, and it doesn't last all year long, and a lot of people don't get a lot of work. So this is a big change. You know, it's an easy fix. Hey, we'll just raise the level of eligibility. Suddenly, thousands of people won't qualify. It's not made lightly, I'm sure, but it's a very serious situation, and I don't think this is a great fix. It's just sort of saying, oh, well, you're on your own. Well, a lot of actors don't make a lot of money. $18,000 a year is probably more than, I wonder what the percentage is. It'd be nice to know. Well, how many actors a year make $18,000 or more, people who are members of SAG-AFTRA? If you know, tell us.
Yes, you can write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's D-I-R-T at showbizsandbox.com. Or you could call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. We're also on Twitter, where our handle is @showbizsandbox, or on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. Wow, now that's a layup, okay? I had no idea you were going to. Now, you mentioned that Kamala Harris is, you know, a woman and also Joe Biden's vice presidential running mate. But women are also ruling the Billboard charts this week. First, Taylor Swift tops the album charts for the third week in a row with her new album, Folklore. And on the singles chart, Megan Thee Stallion, who obviously is a Shakespearean character.
Keep going.
And Cardi B.
That's because you're right
now. Yeah. Come on, Thee. I'm playing off the word Thee. Come on.
All right.
Well, those two are heating things up with their sexy and empowered collaboration called WAP, which we will not explain what that stands for. When CeeLo Green chided them for being so sexually frank, the internet was not having it. The women also set a record. WAP scored a record 93 million streams, the most for any song in its first week. Take that, Drake. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big deal. It's very exciting. Taylor Swift has one of the big albums of the year, Megan Thee Stallion, and it's Cardi B with Megan Thee Stallion. They have a big, big hit here. There's one big reason this happened. Billboard started including stats from YouTube recently, at the beginning of the year, I think. They started streamlining the way that info got included in their charts. So all those plays contribute to their totals. It was happening before, but they're doing it in a more streamlined way. And so this is a big hit song. They sold 125,000 copies of that song digitally and it's being streamed all over the place. But I like the fact that Billboard led with the streaming info. That's what matters. Yes, it sold 125,000 copies. That ain't chicken feed, but the real story is streaming because that's where most of the activity is happening. I think Billboard should just stop trying to convert streams into album sales like they did for Taylor Swift and just say, you know, this is where people are. This is what they do. The new metric for albums and music, you should be talking about streaming. If you want to talk about digital and album sales, fine, on a different chart. But the one that matters is streaming. That's where it's at. Stop trying to turn apples into oranges. Focus on streaming. That's where all the action is happening.
Well, now, speaking of music, Phil Collins.
I can feel it coming in the air tonight. I'm sorry.
If only I had my drum kit. Well, Phil Collins got a lift when two teens, okay, they're twins, they recorded themselves listening to his classic In the Air Tonight, which you just heard with Michael breaking every copyright rule. Well, no, actually.
No, fair use.
Yeah, we don't need a mechanical license. We need a performance license. Anyway, they were listening to this on video. And of course, they had never heard it before. And everybody who has heard it before was sitting there waiting for that drum fill, that famous drum fill that, of course, everybody knows from Miami Vice. I think used it quite well in their theme music. Everybody's waiting for that, and of course they don't know what's coming, and they flipped out when they heard how great it was. Naturally, some people started streaming the song, and the LA Times reported that sales skyrocketed some 1,000% in the days following the video going viral. That may help explain why Warner Brothers just spent $85 million on a company called IMGN Media, okay? This is a company that owns no music at all. It used to create humorous videos, and now it targets millennials while churning out memes and viral videos on Instagram, TikTok, and the like. Hey, that's what the kids are watching, and Warner Brothers wants to reach them. They want to know what's going on with these kids. What is hot? So is this a big deal? Big whoop.
Well, it's a big deal for the people in that company. It makes sense. You know, you want to reach them where they are. You can, you know, this company's got a good track record of reaching people and creating stuff, content that kids will watch. And, you know, you can help promote things. You can help. You got to do it in a way that they buy, however. But, you know, it's working for them right now. My big problem here is the coverage of the Phil Collins song. The LA Times headline was talking about how sales of the Phil Collins song skyrocketed. Well, no, they didn't. They sold 4,600 copies. That's more than the week earlier when they sold a couple hundred copies. And so, yes, sales increased 1,000%, but that's ridiculous. It sold 4,000 copies. You can see the number one song on the chart sold 125,000 copies. That's a lot of copies. Talking about percentages is what you do when you want to hide the fact that it didn't actually really sell that much. Okay.
So what you're saying is if somebody paid us a dollar to do this show, we would be receiving a 100%.
Right. Or $2. And the next week, $2, it'd be 100% increase. Right, exactly. Right. So they were ignoring the reality of what was going on with the song. So you say, okay, it didn't really sell that many copies. I mean, it sold a few. That's great. So I guess streams increased a lot. Well, actually, they didn't. Even though I sort of said they did, that's kind of what you think happens. But the LA Times clarified this here. Their headline was not the best, but they said, actually, streams of the video for the song did not increase notably. Mostly what this benefit was, the two guys who filmed themselves watching the song. It sold a couple copies, but mostly it boosted them. And their channel on YouTube got a bunch of new likes and a bunch of new followers. That wasn't their intention, was to not promote the Phil Collins song. And obviously we're talking about it. But in this new world, what that brought attention to was the two guys who created the video. It did not really increase sales of the song that much. 4,000 copies is nothing to be, you know, it's nothing. And streams, weirdly, did not increase that much. You'd think people would start streaming the song. But in fact, what they did was they streamed the two guys listening to the song. So that's the world we're listening to. Content is being used. It's helping to promote other people. It does sell ads because, you know, there are ads before and after them watching that song, I'm sure. And so that makes money for them and for other people, but it ain't about sales. So don't tout like 1,000% increase when it's misleading.
You know, I think that, first of all, I saw this trending days and days ago, maybe even a week ago. I saw In the Air Tonight and Phil Collins trending. Now, when Phil Collins is trending in this day and age, I went, oh no.
Well, he's about to tour again, you know? What's wrong?
So, I thought either he's touring, he's got the corona, or something really bad has happened. So, and sure enough, it had nothing to do with any of those things. It was these guys, these twin brothers who were, you know, listening to his song, and people like loved his the reaction to the song, because of course what these two brothers have figured out is that the people that are watching them all know the music. They're older, they know the music, and they're going to love watching the reaction of people who have never heard the music before.
Right.
So, and they do this quite often with all sorts of music.
Right. And to clarify, Phil Collins' music is not the theme song to Miami Vice. That song is by Jan Hammer. Jan Hammer was a big hit. They did use it in an episode, and it was really well framed. It was really, used very nicely in an episode. They were famous for, you know, showcasing songs. It was very cinematic show. One of the early shows, well, not early, but certainly one that they wedded down the streets and they shot it so everything looked cool at night. They used music very prominently. It hadn't been done for a long time like that on television. And Phil Collins was certainly a multiple benefactor from that. You know, Glenn Frey, they used Smuggler Blues. They used You Belong to the City. You know, there's all sorts of songs that they showcased. But the theme song is by Jan Hammer.
Okay, well, my mistake. We were corrected even before the show ended. Actually, I was corrected before the show ended. You know, we've already been gabbing away for over 45 minutes, so we should probably move on to Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. Now, we're going to revisit two topics from last week. First, the WGA signed a deal with ICM, thus at least beginning the end of television packaging.
That's right. And I think this is a big deal. The Writers Guild took on packaging, which has been a huge fact of life in the industry for decades. And they've surely weakened it a great deal. You talked about studios packaging, but studios don't package. It's the agents that package.
Well, they take the package. So studios will take film package.
They don't
package.
Make them happen. It's the agents who say, all right, I've got a director, a writer, and a star. Right. Here's the whole concept. Right. Last week's episode, when I was listening to it for a few reasons, that confused me a little bit. I just wanted to clarify that. But they signed a deal with ICM. They now have two major talent agencies on board. That means their deal will go into effect over the next 2 years for all the people who have signed on to their new agreement. There are sunset clauses for packaging, and also agencies can own 20% of independent production companies. I think those are the main texts. And we said, who's next? Now that they've done it, we've got two big agents left. We've got CAA and William Morris Endeavor. And you say you believe if one of them is going to sign, you think it's going to be WME.
Right. Just because they have a lot of financial pressure on them. They have $4 billion in debt. They pretty much, anybody that's going to come and save them might turn around and say, listen, you know, we'll give you some money. We'll you know, keep you from bankruptcy. However, you got to solve this WGA thing.
Right. Well, now you said, you know what? Packaging is almost a thing of the past anyway. Everybody's doing the streaming deal. Everyone's doing a Netflix style deal. They'll say, look, we'll give you more money up front, but then we're going to own it forever because we're NBC. We've got this cable channel now, Peacock. We don't want all this nonsense. There's no back end. We'll pay you more up front, and you don't have to worry about whether it goes to back end. You're going to get more money to start with. You say it's not really a big deal that they triumphed over a way of doing business that is going the way of the dodo. To which I say, well, then why were they fighting? Why didn't they just agree to it? If packaging is so passe, why are they and why is there a sunset clause? You said, look at the Paramount decree. Why is there a sunset clause against block booking and other stuff? Because it's going to be a problem. And I say, that's because there's still a lot of money being made in packaging. What do you say to that?
Well, I think there is a lot of money being made in packaging, but less and less so over time.
It depends. If you're saying it's not a big deal, it's no big, you know, it's disappearing. Why were they fighting it tooth and nail?
Also, you have a lot of, well, because they're trying to not do what with broadcasters and with cable companies or cable networks. They're all turning and saying, oh, we're doing a Netflix deal. You know, all those companies are saying, oh, yeah, we're not going to be doing a packaging deal. We're going to be doing a Netflix deal because they're trying to get what Netflix gets, which is, you know, perpetuity.
Less money up front, and you own it for right again. So, which I say, if you think packaging is no big deal, why were they fighting it? Why is there a sunset clause for the next 2 years? Why were they in this big imbroglio in the first place? Why didn't they just say, fine, whatever? You know, they concede that and get something else they want. There's a lot of money. There's a lot.
5 to 10 years.
Well, there's a lot of money. No, but there's still worldwide. There's lots of back end and lots of. There are still shows that'll go into syndication. You think syndication is never going to happen again? Or there are shows that'll go on to Peacock and syndication, or there, you know, there are types. Right. So there's a lot of money still being made there. The only reason they fought it was because there's money there and they didn't want to give it up.
Well, AMC gave something up. They gave up the farm.
They certainly did. They signed a deal with Universal Studios that shreds theatrical windows, assuming other people sign on and it actually happens. Nothing is going to happen if just one chain agrees to it. That's, I think, your big point. Yes, AMC signed this deal with Universal. Yes, they said you can start showing movies on streaming, premium video on demand, just 17 days after it opens in theaters in North America. But you're saying, well, relax, because unless Regal and Cinemark and others sign up, that's not going to happen anyway.
Yeah, because the reality is that if AMC says, okay, we'll play your film for 17 days, so you can open, if you're Universal, you can open in AMC theaters. But then Regal and Cinemark are going to say, yeah, well, guess what? We're not going to play you. So it's great. So you know, now we only have, you know, of that 50% of the market that all those three chains make up, now we only have just AMC. We can't.
But AMC
open
is basically in every market that Regal and Cinemark is, aren't they?
I mean, if you're not playing, every market. Not every market. There are some markets where it's more Regal heavy and less AMC.
But mostly you're going to be covering 80% of the big markets in the country. You're going to be all the big places you want to be. It's not like there are big cities without an AMC theater.
There are, but not many.
Yeah.
You know, they'll have a Cinemark instead.
So you think this just gives AMC some good news, allows them to restructure their debt yet again?
I think that's really what it amounted to. I think whoever came in and said, well, we'll pay you the $300 million, you're not going to go bankrupt. However, you have to solve this tiff that you're having with
Universal.
And I think Adam Aron came along and he either knowingly said, all right, I'm going to do something that nobody else will ever do. So I know that, like, yes, I'm going to solve the problem, quote unquote, in a way that I never have to actually do anything about it because it will never actually be triggered. I think that might be what happened here.
Right. But his end goal is to end the 90-day theatrical window. They tried to push for a 30-day theatrical window and everybody ran screaming like the scene in Airplane.
You mean Adam Aron's deal? No, Aron would. You mean Universal's?
Universal.
Yes,
Universal
correct.
Wanted a 30-day deal and everybody went yelling and screaming, oh my God, like that scene in Airplane where everybody in the plane panics. You know, they throw everything up in the air, they run around screaming. It's very exciting. So if they do this deal for 17 days, the thinking from us is that, well, they'll freak everyone out. And then when Regal and Cinemark sign a deal to shorten the theatrical window to 45 days or even 30 days, they'll feel like they dodged a bullet.
Correct.
But in fact, that window that they've been fighting to defend for quite a while now is going to die. The 90-day window will die, don't you think?
I think distribution will be different. Film distribution after coronavirus will change, not only here in the United States, but I can tell you what is going on internationally. How much does a film distributor make internationally from ticket sales, theatrical ticket sales? We've covered this before, Michael, so you know how much they make. Do you remember?
Well, it's not always as much as it is in the U.S. In a lot of territories, it is 40-50%, right? It's just in China, it's not. It's 25%.
Right. So you said 40 or 50%, right?
Right.
Right. You know what it isn't? 55% or 60%, which is what some of these big blockbuster films. Now, I'm saying something here without pointing to a specific studio. However, Disney put their film on Disney Plus, so they're not negotiating with theater chains at all right now. However, there is a studio or two that is going out with a big major film that is causing a few ripples by internationally finally trying to get more than 50% on the release.
But they won't be getting that in China.
Well, not in China. But elsewhere.
So what territories are still shortchanging Hollywood as far as Hollywood is concerned?
All of Europe, all of Latin America, Russia. It's basically been 50 or 45 or 40.
Mm-hmm.
Now you've got studios coming in going, we're going to ask for 55%.
For our big movies.
For big movies, yeah.
Not necessarily for Knives Out. but for Star Wars, The Force Awakens, for Marvel's next Avengers movie, they're going to be asking for a bigger cut. Can they keep doing that?
By the way, in the US, they're also asking, they're like, we'll take a 64%, which, by the way, is more than the 63% than they asked for big, huge movies like Star Wars or Avengers.
63% for the entire theatrical run?
For the entire theatrical run.
Wow, that's a lot more money.
Right.
So my question is, we feel like the 90-day window is this, you know, it's been there forever, but it hasn't been that long because their ability to go right to premium video on demand and stuff like that has, it's been around for decades, but not that long, right? I mean, how long has this 90-day theatrical window been in force?
Years.
20 years?
At least 20.
Well, I mean, because before that, it would have been you can't put it on DVD for 90 days, right?
Correct. Right. Yeah, it was a lot harder, basically. It was a lot harder to... Plus, there were all these windows that depended on theatrical, so your broadcast television rights were
cable
25%.
Rights.
Yeah, exactly. So they all, like, you'd need a huge gross theatrically to then turn to NBC or the BBC or whoever and say... Well, 25% of Jurassic Park's theatrical gross in your country was X, so we'll take that. Thank you very much.
Well, I've long argued that theater chains should be flexible. Say, look, if a movie is dropped off 90% of the screens it peaked at, let them put it on premium video on demand if they want to. If it's a flop, if it's gone from your theaters, why would you care if they went to premium video on demand? You obviously don't want to do it when a movie's making a lot of money, but neither will the studio. So we felt like there should be some flexibility there. And I think people could adjust. They'd be okay. They wouldn't be confused if a movie was in theaters and then short time later shows up on premium video on demand, because it already feels like it happens pretty darn quick. And last time we went through the charts, I won't go through them all again, but I went through the top 21 movies of 2019. And a handful of other movies that looked like they would have had legs and been running a long time. And I said, how much of their gross did they make after the first 30 days? How much of their gross did they make after 45 days? Whether it's Avengers Endgame or going down to The Secret Life of Pets or Pokemon, Detective Pikachu, or Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, Shazam, Knives Out. It's very rare. When you get to 45 days, you're talking 5% or less, 1%, 2%,
3%. I heard from a very smart person recently that you only use percentages when you want to hide the real numbers. And the real numbers aren't
that. So you think, why would they care about if less than 5% of Avengers Endgame's money was made after the first 45 days? You think, well, right, but 5% of what? If you're looking at $850 million in North America, well, that means 10% is 85, which means 5% is $42 million.
Did you want to throw $42 million away?
Right. And that's $42 million obviously split up among a bunch of theater chains, not just no one chain gets it all. Maybe the top three get 60 or 70% of it. So that would be, say, $30 million.
It has nothing to do with
And now you're talking about
chains.
AMC is going to get $10 million. So that's $10 million. That's real money. $10 million is real money. But that's, of course, the biggest film of the year. And, of course, if a movie's still making money, like Knives Out made 20% of its money after the first 45 days. Well, guess what? The studio behind that is not going to want to yank it and throw it on premium video on demand, I don't think. They're still making good money. I think they'd say, well, we have the right to, but we're not going to. Obviously, most of the money is made within the first 30 days, certainly within the first 45 days, whether you're talking about long-running hits or big, huge blockbusters, movies that are successful or movies that have failed. Most of it is played out within 45 days, absolutely. Obviously, you look at the top 10 movies of the year, that's where most of the money is. It can be some real money. It adds up. But if you're getting a cut of premium video on demand and you can get a piece of that, you might actually be getting the same or more money than you would otherwise. So I think it's certainly something worth looking at. I don't think it's as scary or frightening a possibility as theaters may think. And I always believe if a movie is off 90% or 95% of its screens, you should let automatically trigger it and say, sure, fine. You're off, the screens are at your peak.
You know what?
We're not showing it. Why not let you take it to premium video on demand?
You mentioned that if you could get a cut, and AMC is getting a cut of we don't know the particulars per se, but for 4 years they're going to get a cut of this PVOD. What do you think is going to happen after that 4 years? Do you think they're still going to get the same deal? No, they're not.
Well, then they won't. Then they won't. Then they will not sign the deal again. It's always a new negotiation. Next movie comes out, they still want, your studio still going to want 60%. They're going to want to pay 40%. You got to come to, if they say, all right, we want 90% of our next movie, you don't sign the deal. I mean, you're never forced to take a new deal.
The theatrical window is not dead yet.
It's not dead at all. It's hugely important.
But you know who is?
Who?
Without a doubt, this past week, the biggest death in the entertainment industry was somebody we thought would never die, actually.
Yeah, I don't know about that.
It was Sumner Redstone.
That's right. He hung on to the end of his life, just as he famously hung on to a windowsill when a fire broke out in a hotel and he clung to a life. He got burns over like 45% of his body. He donated money to burn centers and research for the rest of his life. But mogul Sumner Redstone dies at 97. He was a lawyer who loved to sue. He coined the phrase content is king. He started in drive-ins, right? Everything old is new again. And then became a pioneer of the multiplex concept. He helped end blind bidding, where chains didn't know what other people were bidding. He did it by suing Disney. He battled YouTube, sued them to start enforcing takedown notices. He probably sued us. And he bought CBS, Viacom,
you're probably right. Yeah.
And Paramount Pictures. And he's very well known, one of those colorful moguls. But you also look at all the people who he paid poorly and steamrolled over in his career. You know, people love to talk about these great titans of industry. You actually look at what they did. It's not always pleasant and nice for the people who worked for them and the companies that got ran out of business. But he is certainly a major figure in Hollywood.
Do you think that actor Linda Manns ever worked for Paramount and got paid poorly by Sumner Redstone?
I don't think Linda Manns got much of a paycheck ever. She's a throaty actress. She died at 58, made a splash in the Terrence Malick classic Days of Heaven. She played Richard Gere's little sister and the narrator, Terrence Malick being famous for his voiceover narration. She also appeared in Dennis Hopper's Out of the Blue as a kid obsessed with punk rock and The Wanderers. But, you know, a few classic films early on and people will still remember her because those movies are so important to them and stick out so strongly. So she didn't have a great career, but she certainly had a memorable one. I'd say the same for singer Trini Lopez, who died at 83. He was a groundbreaking folk pop singer, not a very important one creatively, but an important one for people who want to champion his Mexican roots. When a lot of other people tried to hide them, just like Richie Valens, he celebrated it both by keeping his name and by the songs he did, singing in Spanish and English, making sounds of in his live albums that you go, this is not, you know, Pat Boone, baby. This is a guy celebrating his roots. He had big number one hits with If I Had a Hammer and Lemon Tree, managing to outsell Peter, Paul, and Mary on both of them. Sinatra helped sign him. Trini Lopez couldn't get arrested, but Sinatra saw him in concert. They signed him to Reprise Records. They made his first album a live album, which is virtually never done. I can't think of another example off the top of my head. And it was a huge hit. Never really matched it. If I Had a Hammer was a number one hit in like 36 countries or something like that. He designed guitars for Gibson, appeared in the film The Dirty Dozen. But he got so bored waiting around on set, he left. And so his role got cut down. And sadly, he died from complications of COVID-19.
Ugh.
The same is not true for Emmy-winning composer Billy Goldenberg, who died at 84. He won his Emmy for his work on TV movies. He did the theme songs to Rhoda and Kojak. He had a lot of theater stuff, too. He got his break playing piano for Mike Nichols and Elaine May on their breakout Broadway show. He also did the same thing with Bea Arthur when she appeared on Broadway. Also worked with Barbara Streisand, a lot of other people. The dumbest thing Billy Goldenberg ever did, he would tell you this himself. He worked with Spielberg in television. He scored the Night Gallery episodes. He did his TV movie Duel. And then Spielberg said, hey, I'm making a theatrical film. Here's my script. Can you read it? And he couldn't even be bothered to read the Sugarland Express. He was too busy. Then John Williams got the deal.
The rest is history, slapping
my forehead. But he had a long career. The best thing he ever did influentially is probably working on Elvis Presley's 68 comeback special. Arguably, his work on that was key to Elvis embracing the sound he did in the 70s with lots of strings and big arrangements, for better or for worse.
Well, hopefully this show was better and not worse than, I don't know. I had no place to go with
You're
that.
You're fine than last week's. At least it's shorter. It may not be better. Yeah. It may not be worse, but it's certainly shorter.
Not by much, for Pete's sake. You know, you can subscribe to our show in iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts out for free. You can rate and review the show there in any one of those podcast aggregators. It does help us out when you do that. Links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find those ways to subscribe to us. Please do subscribe to us. Or ways to contact us. Dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's DIRT@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail at 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. We're on Twitter. We're at Showbiz Sandbox is our handle. And we're on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. We have a website at showbizsandbox.com. MGMT has a website. It's whoismgmt.com. Michael Gilt has a website. And every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's womendorulethworld.com.
That actually might be a real website where you can find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry. However, if you go to michaelgiltz.com, all of his work and all of his journalistic endeavors can be found there. Of course, some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.
God, I was looking up Phil Collins and In the Air Tonight. Do you know what that song is about? He was walking on the beach and this guy was dropped. Never mind.
Yeah, that's not true. You know that, right?